My name is Jim Groves, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. My sobriety date is July 8th, 1998, and for that I'm truly grateful. My sponsor's name is Al, and my home group is the Trinity Group in Danville, Virginia. We have a big book meeting on Friday nights at 8 o'clock and a step meeting on Saturday nights at 8 o'clock. I'd like to thank Billy for inviting me to come up and speak. He can't wait to hear my story because he's going to find out why I would drive 3 hours to speak, but he'll hear it. I grew up in what can best be described as a dysfunctional family. My father was a very angry man, and he was also an alcoholic. If he couldn't curse you to shut up, he would curse louder till you shut up and agreed with him. And my mother was the ultimate peacemaker. My father would tell us at 3 o'clock on a sunny afternoon that it was too dark to go outside, and my mother would say, "Now you heard your father, it's too dark to go outside." But that's not why I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because I have an allergy to alcohol. I'll stop on my way home from work on a Monday night to have two drinks. And I come to on Thursday in Las Vegas. Once I start drinking, I cannot control the amount I drink. And I have an obsession of the mind. The first part of that is I've never had two drinks in my life. Why would I believe that I'm going to stop and have two drinks? But I like to tell a story about when I was maybe 3 years old. My mother was changing a light bulb in one of the lamps, and being a curious kid, I stuck my finger in the socket. And it shocked the hell out of me. But you know, in almost 60 years, I have never stuck my finger in another lamp socket. I never said, you know, well, that happened in Pennsylvania. Now that I'm living in Virginia, it's going to be different. I never said, well, maybe that ceiling socket would be different. I never said that. But when alcohol was concerned, every time I believed the lie that this time it was going to be different. And that's what makes me an alcoholic. When I started my junior year of high school, a friend of mine who I hadn't seen over the summer, who was a little bit more mature than I was, a little bit more worldly, discovered that we could go into D.C. Now, I went to high school in Arlington, Virginia. We could go into D.C. at certain restaurants, and they didn't card you. I figured, hey, this is great, you know. So Friday night was football and date night. Saturday night, we took off down to the Bavarian restaurant. Now, this place had two sections separated by a big arched door. One side was a restaurant. The other side, they had the long beer tables, and they served the beer in those big clay German steins. And that's where I had my first drink of alcohol. And it was just absolutely magical. You know, I was shy, low self-esteem, depressed, suffered from anxiety. I was just a ball of nerves growing up. And I drank that first beer, and it was just wonderful. I mean, all that stuff just kind of disappeared. Well, if one's good, two's got to be better, right? So, I got drunk, and I got sick. Couldn't wait till next Saturday night. We went back down. I got drunk, I got sick, and I got in trouble. So I got caught by my parents this time. The third week, and I sometimes wonder now if they weren't busy for a reason, but everybody else seemed to be busy that Saturday night. So I got on the bus and went downtown by myself to that restaurant, got drunk, threw up on the bus coming home. Now, I lived maybe 2.5 short blocks from the bus stop. I made it maybe half a block and wandered into a neighbor's yard and fell asleep against a tree. And I was just getting started. So, the alcoholic that I was, my next step was, in the spring of my junior year, I quit school to become a hippie. Now, this was the summer of 1967, the summer of love, and it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I had a blast. I have to admit, I had an absolute blast that summer. Toward the end of the summer, this one girl and I decided we were going to go to San Francisco. So she borrowed her mother's credit card and got some sleeping bags and some camping stuff and everything we need for this trip. And I decided to borrow some money from a store that I had worked at. Well, I got caught. And I spent 2 months in jail. Now, getting out of jail, I was now 18. There was a shooting war going on. And I decided, well, I'm going back to school and become a student, because students had deferments back then. So I got my GED. I enrolled in Northern Virginia Community College, just enough credits to keep that deferment. And then I worked, so I had some drinking money. And again, life, I was having a ball. Life was good, you know. When I started drinking, I could talk to girls. I could never talk to girls before. And after my experiences that summer, you know, I had no problem talking to girls, and it was just great. Now, back then, because the following year, what you have to remember is back then they had a lottery system for the draft. And every January they would pull birthdays out of the hat. So if the first one they picked out was May 12th, you were number one, you might as well pack your bag. Well, that year my number was like 362. So I said, okay, I quit school and put my name in the hat, because I figured there's no way that I was going to get taken, and I didn't get taken. So then I could really concentrate on my drinking. And, you know, like I said, I was having a ball, but I was having trouble keeping relationships. Women, for some reason, get a little bit upset when you throw up on their bedroom carpet, or you pee in the closet. And I was just having this trouble. Now, I'm 20 years old, and I meet this girl, and I really liked her. So I'm 20 years old, and I have my first conscious thought, I have to watch my drinking. And I did. And this relationship went on for like 6 weeks, which was a record for me. And one night, for some reason, we stayed home. I don't know if she wasn't feeling well or what the story was. So we went to bed early. And I couldn't sleep. So I figured, well, you know, she's asleep. I'm going to get up and have a few drinks, get me to sleep. So I got up, got drunk, went back to bed. Now, sometime between 3 and 3:30, I wake up to the call of nature. So I go into the bathroom, but I'm going to be smart. Okay? I'm going to sit down. One, I'm not going to miss. And two, if there's anybody else in here that's ever been woken up in the middle of the night by a woman screaming and then cursing your name, then you learn about putting the seat down. So I did that, and I bounced back down the hallway into bed, and I'm thinking, you know, maybe I'm making too much of this drinking stuff, you know? And then I'm laying there a minute more, and it dawns on me that these boobs are a little bit bigger than what I remembered. And at that point, her roommate woke up and started screaming. I had maneuvered back to the wrong bedroom. So that relationship didn't last. I finally met someone that wanted to fix me. And that was great, because I could get away with anything, because she was very patient. So patient, I married her. And I could just get away with anything. And that lasted about 6 years. And then she had just given up on me, I guess. So we started to go to marriage counseling with the minister at our church. And I liked this right away because he took my side. I mean, I had a business that was in bankruptcy. I had all these other problems. And he was just more or less saying, you know, cut him a break. You know, until this stuff is over, just let him go. I found out later when I went back to make amends to that man, because I did take advantage of his misguided notions, that his father had died of alcoholism, and he didn't have a clue. And I was able to help him with that later on, which is, you know, part of what we get from this program. So we're going to the marriage counselor, and she's not getting what she wants out of it. So she talks to a member of our church who husband goes to AA. She gave me his name and his phone number. She said, you need to call him and talk to him about your drinking. I said, okay. You know, I mean, I could talk. So I'm going to call him and I'm going to talk to him. So Charles came over. And Charles was, if I had drawn a picture of what an alcoholic looks like, it would have been Charles. His face was drawn and ashen. He had a jacket on with patches. I guess he told me his story. I mean, I had been drinking, of course. Now, I watched what I drank because I was having company come over. And he left me a big book. I found out later, because this was like March of April of 1976. And by that fall, Charles was dead. He'd been diagnosed with cancer. And he took that evening out of his life that he could have been spending with his family to come talk to a drunk he didn't know. And, you know, it was just great. It was just great. So he left, and I picked up the big book. And we were discussing not too long ago that nobody ever reads the chapter of the wives. Well, that was the first chapter I read. I figured I'm going to find the answer to my problems right here. And I read a lot of that book that night. Now, what I got out of it, I don't know, I'll never be able to tell you. Because I wasn't ready to stop drinking. I mean, I had all this other stuff I had to take care of first. But then, I mean, by that time I was a maintenance drinker. I was drinking 24/7. A good day was waking up at 3:30 in the morning so I could have a couple drinks. And then when I woke up at 7 when the alarm went off, I wasn't sick. I could go about my day. You know, a bad day was sleeping through the night and taking that first drink into the bathroom because you know it's coming up. And then doing my thing and going off to work. Well, I reached the point where I take that morning drink, and the next thing you know, I'm coming to, and it's 11:30, 12:30 in the afternoon. So, I reached that point where, you know what, I have to stop drinking. And I went into treatment. This was the Arlington Hospital Program. Back then it was 2 weeks, not 4 weeks, but it was a good, intense program. And I came out of there with all this knowledge. I've got this thing lit. Now, let me say something real quick about Arlington. There were 7 of us in there at that time. Tom has been sober now for 34 years. I'm sober. 3 of the people are dead as a direct result of their alcoholism. Well, 1 committed suicide, which to me is a direct result of your alcoholism. One person, I don't know where they are, and the other fella, I ran into him last year. I was going to meetings in Fairfax at at the Lamb Center, which is... they provide services for the homeless. You can go in there and wash your clothes, and go in there and take a shower, use the telephone, read the classified ads. They serve a lunch every day. And they have AA meetings at 12:30 every day. and I was going to those 12:30 meetings. Well, I saw Chris there. And Chris came into the AA meetings and to talking the same stuff he was talking 34 years ago. I mean, he knows more spiritually than I'll ever hope to know. He has read every piece of literature on religion and the religions of the world that have ever been written. But he hasn't gotten it yet. You know? So, I am fortunate in that way. So, needless to say, I drank again. And now I'm really baffled because I wanted to quit. So I figured, well, maybe these AA people know what they're doing. So I called and talked to Charles, and he took me to a Saturday night meeting in Annandale. Across here, Buck Doyle's old Saturday Night Live. And that was way before the TV show. And I saw what I wanted to see. I saw a room full of old people. We had a guy making coffee that used to be the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. Used to throw strippers into the tidal basin. He needed to be there. The only thing I remember about the speaker was that he used to sleep under the Key Bridge. He needed to be there. But I didn't see anything for Jim. So, I drink again. And I figured, well, you know, I got to give AA another chance. But this time, I'm going to do what they say. So, I go back to AA and I heard, don't drink, go to meetings. I heard, take what you want, leave the rest. Now, I could do that. Okay. Now, there might have been somebody there that said, get a sponsor and take the steps, but I didn't hear it. All right. And that does not work for me. I don't want to be controversial. I would get 13, 14 months, and the craziness inside of me would be so great that I would drink, and I'd get that 30, 45 seconds of relief, and then I'd get drunk. Now, I think I picked up 4 one-year chips. You know, you always hear me people in meetings talk about how many white chips they got. I got 4 one-year chips. So finally, after the fourth year, and this is 1981, I'm maybe sober 13, 14 months, and I go into the Boston group. And there's a fellow there named Will, and he's still there to this day. He's probably been there running that meeting now for close to 30 years. And he says, you know what? He said, you're not going to get that second year unless you do a fourth and a fifth step. And then the other steps after that. Now, you have to remember, when I first came into AA, if you told me you had 5 years sobriety, I didn't believe you. Because if you were like me, there's no way you could not drink for 5 years. If you had 90 days, I want to know what you're doing. Because I want to get 90 days. But I've known Will now for 5 years. And I know that he was sober when I met him, and he was still sober. So maybe he knows what he's talking about. So I got to 12 and 12, and I got the Hazleton Guide. And I probably wrote the worst four-step I've ever seen in my life. And I won't show it to anybody else, but I still have it. And then I did the fifth step with that minister I told you about. And then I went through 6 and 7, and I started making amends. And what do you know? I got 2 years. And then I got 3 years. And on and on and on. I'm going to check the time here. Right. I'm going to fast forward to when I'm 12 years sober. You know, I've heard speakers talk about when you go back out, you do the steps in reverse. And I said, no, that's not the case with me. Because I prayed right up until the end. But then I remembered that I was praying right from the beginning too. So maybe it was right. I'd gone to a meeting on a Monday night, and somebody from Leesburg, Virginia, asked me to come out and speak at their Wednesday night meeting. Their speaker had broken a leg or gotten sick, and they needed somebody to fill in. Now, in my head, I'm going, okay, 45 minutes to Leesburg, an hour and a half at the meeting, 45 minutes back on a Wednesday night. So I lied to him. I said, you know what, I'd love to, but I got something else going on that night. And I felt really bad. But the next time I did it, I didn't feel as bad. And the time after that, it came out of my mouth and I wouldn't even think about it. So that was the start of me, instead of being in AA, I just started to be around AA. I stopped sponsoring people. Now, if you had told me that in 5 years I would be drunk, I'd have bet you all the money I had. If you'd have bet me at that time that within 7 years I'd be in prison, I'd have borrowed money to bet you. But that's exactly what happened. I'm 16 years sober. And again, this is, it's, you know, I made a decision I was going to drink again. Why I waited until my anniversary was over, I cannot answer that question. One question I can answer is that in the back of my mind, I figured, well, if this doesn't work out, I can always go back to AA. Now, my sister called me not too long ago and told me about someone, she says I know them. My sister's from Buffalo, New York. She says I know them. I can't remember them. But he had been at his home group on Thursday night. He was sober 10 years. Friday, coming home from work, he stopped at a liquor store. He got drunk, fell down the steps, and died. And the first thought in my mind was, I wonder if he, in the back of his mind, said to himself, well, if this doesn't work, I can always go back to AA. We never know. I've heard people swear that if they drink again, they'll never come back. They don't know that. Nobody knows that but the power that's greater than I am. And he doesn't tell me any secrets. So, I was fortunate to get back. I struggled for the next 2 years. Let me tell you a little bit about my history with sponsors before I go on to my new sponsor. Charles died. Ben was the second sponsor I got, and he was dead of cancer within 6 months from the time I asked him to sponsor me. I asked Ken to sponsor me, and this was my wife's suggestion, because his wife was very big in Al-Anon and a circuit speaker and all this other stuff. And I figured, okay, I can't go wrong with this guy. Well, he killed himself about 3 months after I asked him to sponsor me. The next guy I asked drank again, and assaulted me and his son when we tried to intervene. So I didn't have much luck with sponsors. And I didn't have a sponsor when I did the fourth and the fifth step the first time. That's years 3 through 16 I didn't have a sponsor. So, my brother-in-law's name is Al. And I really never liked Al. Well, I liked him until he went from playing golf to taking up fishing. But once he quit playing golf, I didn't care too much for Al. And my sister doesn't like this, but I say, you know, I mean, how smart could he be? He married my sister, you know? But I had noticed a change in him. And we were talking one day, And he told me that he had gone through the same thing that I went through, only he went through it for 6 years and he didn't drink. But he was stark raving sober for those 6 years. Then he met someone that took him through the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, okay, let's do it. And we did. And I am so grateful for that. I'm not going to say I did it right this time, but I sure did it differently. Now, one of the things I got out of last weekend, when I was down at Pockets, there were four or five speakers all talking about the big book. That's the good thing. But they all did it differently. You know? One group goes through a chapter a week. Frank says, I'm not going to read the book with you. You read it. And then there are people that did it the way that I still do it, is I take a newcomer through the book, and we go sentence by sentence, and where it says pray, we pray, where it says write, we write, until we've gone through the first 164 pages. But what I got out of the weekend was the fact that they all did it. That's the key. You have to do it. You can do it the way that I was taught. You can do it the way your sponsor was taught. The key is you have to do it. You know, for me, there was no other way. So I've done this. And I'm making amends. And I'm getting ready to go to prison. I know I'm going to prison. Prison can best be described as anxious boredom. Okay? You're anxious because there are some crazy people there. And you're bored because there's nothing to do. So, I made a decision that I wasn't going to waste that time. I went to work in the school, and I helped a lot of people get their GED. A lot of fellows that really wanted to improve their lot in life, I was able to help them. And I was there maybe a month, and I took over, facilitated the AA meeting. Now, when I went to the first AA meeting at Dillon, there was a Muslim running it who wouldn't say the Lord's Prayer at the end. And everybody that was in the group, it was a Bible study is what it was. Because that's all he talked about was the Bible. So when I took it over, and with a friend's help, we made it a meeting about the solution. And I gauged how well I was doing by how many complaints the counselor in charge of AA got about the AA meeting. If he got 3 complaints in 1 week, I figured we had a great meeting. If he only got 1 complaint, I figured, well, I need to try harder. But the most important thing I did was I wrote to New York. And I said, we could use some volunteers here. And they sent out with Mark N. Those two came to the first meeting, then Sage, then Merle. And we went from one meeting every 2 weeks to a meeting a week. I started a big book study on Saturday mornings. Now, getting anything done in prison is, you have no idea. Because inmates are like children. If AA has 2 meetings a week, then the Native American Studies should have 2 meetings a week. Or the NA group should have 2 meetings a week. Or whatever. So, there was a lot of, you know, just trying to convince them that we would start the meeting, keep it going, and if those other people wanted a meeting, why not? You know? And we finally got it approved. And we had the big book study on Saturday meeting. And it was terrific. It was just absolutely terrific. I met a guy there named Vic. Vic is my age. He's actually a year younger. Vic was in there for selling drugs, even though he didn't need the money. But he liked fast cars and he liked the young women that brought him. So he told Al at one of the meetings, and then he told me later, he says, you know what? He said, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I said, okay. You know, but in his words, he would watch what I would do. And then he came back to me and he says, you know what? He said, I am an alcoholic. And I said, I know. I said, you just didn't want to give up the young women. And he said, how do you know that? I said, because I'm an alcoholic too. And I took him through the book, and I still sponsor him today. And we'll get back to the rest of that story. So, I transferred my last year to Deerfield. I went to the AA meetings there. Now, they gave out certificates. So you had people going there to look good for the parole board, you know, to look good for the probation people, and they were terrible meetings. Back at Dillon, Al and Al's sponsor donated anywhere between 200 and 300 tapes that we would listen to. And I love tapes. I listen to them today. I mean, it's just so wonderful to be able to hear. I was listening to Bill W. Today. I mean, he's talking about financing of the big book, and it's just, I just love it. You know, I just absolutely love it. So, I smuggled some tapes that I took with me and tried to get them to listen to the tapes at the meetings. Because to me, this is a message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, they didn't want any part of that. And like I said, I had less than a year, and I had gone through that fight once. I wasn't going to go through it again. And I put it on Vic's lap. I said, this is your baby. And he's still there, still with the meeting, still making improvements with it. So, I'm getting ready to get out of prison, and I'm a firm believer in intuitive thought. You know, God talks to me all the time. Most of the time it's don't do that or don't say that, but he talks to me all the time. And he told me I needed to go to Danville, Virginia when I got out and take care of Vic's mother. Because he's got probably another 3 years and she's 87 years old. And I said, okay, where's Danville, Virginia? So, now I'm probably the only person in this room that does this. But I said, okay, God, but I want to make a bargain with you. When I get out, I want to go to New York first, which was my plan all along, to live with my sister and sponsor. At that time, my sister was living in Arlington, but to live with my sponsor. I want to go to New York for 2 months, get things straightened out. You know how I am. I got to get things organized. And then I'll go to Danville. Well, you would think I would know better than to interfere with God's plans. I spent 2 months in Fairfax waiting for a decision from New York State. And the decision came back, they didn't want me. So my interstate compact was declined. And my sister says, I told you, you don't mess with God's plans. Okay. Let me talk about my sister for a minute. In those early years of in and out of AA, this was one of the times when I was in AA, and my sister, this would have been probably 1977, wrapped her car around a tree coming home from a Christmas party at work. Now, she worked for the government. That was back in the day when, you know, you could have a bottle of liquor in your government office. So I called her up with all this knowledge that I had. And I said, you know what? I said, normal drinkers don't have blackouts. Because she admitted to me that she doesn't remember hitting the tree. She doesn't remember going home. I said, maybe you should go to an AA meeting with me. Well, she told me to screw myself and hung up the phone. Now, if you knew my sister, you would know those were not the words she used. But back in 1980, I come home from work one day in the afternoon. I guess I was working a half day or something. And my sister was sitting at my dining room table. And she said to me, I'm ready. And I said, okay. Now again, she was down visiting from Buffalo. And this is how God works. There was no meeting right then. We went to the intergroup office in Falls Church. Besides the guy answering the phone, there was one person there. He had just moved to Falls Church from Buffalo, New York. So when she went home, she had meetings, names, phone numbers, the whole nine yards. I was fortunate enough to go up to Arlington a few months back and speak at my sister's 30th anniversary. So it's just been great. And she was always there for me. Always there for me. So, all right, so New York doesn't want me. So I'm heading toward Danville, Virginia. Now, I've been in